Aybak, the first of the so-called slave sultans, who took power in 1206 and died in 1210. He commissioned a major building program in this area. His successor, his son-in-law, Iltutish, completed it. And these buildings in the early 13th century come to symbolize the power of the sultans of Delhi. And they are comparable to the building programs that are going on in Konya at the same time. One of them, for instance, is the great, we would call it minaret. It is, however, called the Kutba Minaret, or Minar. That would be the rendition in India of the word minaret. It is an enormous minaret. It, in fact, is the largest in Islam at the time. It is a brick building that soars 240 feet high. It has, I believe, five or six galleries to it. And it was a symbol of victory as much as it was for the Islamic faith. He also began the construction of a major mosque complex right next to that. That complex is really not finished until his successors, especially Iltutmish, expands that mosque. And then there's later additions by the Khalji and even the Tuluk sultans. And I think there may even be some additions, if I remember correctly, in the 15th century before the Mughals. This is a great victory mosque. It is significant for several reasons. One is the mosque, as we know it today, is by the name Quwwat-ul. It means the might of Islam. When you go there, it is an impressive building constructed of brick as well as spolia. Spolia refers to any kind of material that you have seized from older buildings. And it's a term that's used quite often in conjunction with ancient buildings, and it applies here as well. The great mosque ordered by Aybak and completed by his successors is built in part from the spolia, that is the debris, of some 27 Jain and Hindu temples. And if you go there today, you stand in a great open courtyard, an avlu in the Islamic tradition, and that is where the faithful will gather to pray. The avlu, the open area, is actually partially enclosed by these colonnades. And of course, the side facing Mecca is where you direct your prayer. And those colonnades are built from all sorts of pieces of sculpture taken from Hindu and Jain temples. And you can see that it is essentially a memorial complex at the same time that it's a Islamic shrine. In the middle, of course, is the fountain, the chesme, necessary for ablutions for the faithful. Later gates were added to the far end of the complex, and mausoleums, that is, memorial tombs, subsidiary buildings, were added over the course of the next 200 years. But the central mosque itself, next to the great minaret in the Qutbid complex, that announced the victory of Islam. And it is an extraordinary set of monuments. In size and audacity, it dwarfs anything being built by the Seljuk sultans of Konya. Furthermore, in the middle of that avlu, that open courtyard, is the iron column of Chandragupta, not the famous one of the Mauryan dynasty, a later one of the Gupta period of the 4th century. It is a great Hindu monument that has been put in the middle of the avlu to show that, well, it's now good taste. It has now been incorporated as a decorative piece in a Muslim mosque. One wonders what the majority of the Hindu population made of it, because this mosque was built with corvée labor, that is, large numbers of Indians worked on it, and it must have been something of a humiliating job to dismantle your own temples and then use them to build the mosque of the victors. So the building programs of the sultans transformed Delhi into a great city. Delhi previously had been a minor city in India. It now becomes the city of Muslim power in northern India, the natural center of any imperial order, any Raj, as it's later called, that would base itself on the traditional power of the Punjab, the Ganges, and the Doab. Well, the building programs are spectacular. The military operations are far-ranging and really daring. Yet, Islam always remains a minority religion. And this has caused great excitement, great discussion as to what did the conquest or the occupation of the Sultans of Delhi bring for India. This is now clouded with all sorts of nationalist opinions. Muslims always stressing the power of the Turkish horse archers and cavalry. Hindu nationalists deploring the destruction of their shrines. There has been a very good scholarly study on this, and it's an analysis of all the literary reports of temples that were sacked by Muslim armies, essentially running from the time of Muhammad Ghori, that is, let's say, from 1192, down to about the death of the Mughal emperor Aurangzeb, and he dies in 1707. And in that period, there's only really 500 good documentations of the Muslims targeting specific temples to destroy. Sometimes they were driven to loot them to pay the army. Other times they clearly targeted these temples because they were breaking resistance, either a foe or a rebel. But it's not as nearly as many as the text would suggest, where you have thousands of temples, thousands of Brahmins are killed. There's an awful lot of exaggeration. Yet on the other hand, let's not make a mistake here too. The destruction of temples, yes, it occurred when Hindu rulers fought with each other, but it's not supposed to happen. It is quite different when an outside conqueror comes and destroys your religious shrines. It has also been studied very carefully how much impact these first 250, 300 years of Muslim rule in India had on the religions. Buddhism essentially was finished off by the Muslim invasions. The great sanctuary of Nalanda was sacked by armies of Muhammad Ghori, led by one of his subordinates in 1197. But Buddhism was already on the retreat. There were very, very few Buddhist monasteries left. Only the Pala kingdom had supported it. And Buddhism had begun to retreat into Tibet and Central Asia. So at most, the Turks delivered the coup de grace. But in terms of the Hindu populations, there Islam ran up against a powerful hierarchy, a powerful caste system, which is reciprocal, which defines people's life, their place in society, dharma, their destiny, and also the notion of karma, the good acts that will lead the believer to breaking the cycle of rebirths, the cycle of lives, and achieving nirvana, or actually, to be more accurate, moksha in the Hindu tradition, liberation from the pattern of life where your Atman, your soul, will rejoin the world's soul. Those sort of traditions behind Hinduism had long crystallized. And Hindu worship centers around great temples. These temples were really ill-suited to be converted into mosques. Muslims had to build mosques anew. This is quite different from Christian churches that could easily be modified into a mosque. A Hindu temple is essentially the sanctum of the god. It's very, very small, the inner sanctum. They are massive buildings with marvelous decoration, decoration that the Muslims often mistook as erotic and as somehow evil. And really what the sculptural programs on high Hindu temples represent is the mundane world, the world of Maya, illusion, which is distinct from the real world of the god in the sanctum. And if anyone has traveled in India, they would have seen this type of relief sculpture on the outside of the temple. The temples at Khajuraho are particularly telling of this. Muslim soldiers encountering this type of sculpture would have found it anathema. They would have seen it as the idol worship that Muhammad had abolished in Mecca. Nonetheless, it was integral to understanding the message of the Hindu cults, the cults of Shiva and Vishnu. And furthermore, the great cults of India were also linked with the worship of the villages of India, and that is associated with the so-called practices of Tantra. That is the notion that there is a higher allegorical and spiritual meaning behind all the simple rites practiced in the villages across India. And these rites were almost family and village worship and were not dependent on the support of the Brahmins in the temples. And so Islam encountered an institutional religion that had far greater resources and strength behind it than the Turks did in Asia Minor. And as a result, by 1350, where Asia Minor is being converted into an Islamic land, the Sultans of Delhi are ruling over a set of Muslim cities in a largely Hindu countryside. They face powerful Hindu kingdoms to the south and to the east. And in some ways, the Indians come to view the newcomers, the Turkish invaders, not so much as invaders and conquerors, but as a subset of caste, and that Islam, in many ways, becomes much more an Indian religion rather than the Indians become Muslims.
Lecture 26, Manchurian Warlords and Sun Emperors.
This lecture begins the last third of the class. We're going to deal with the rise and impact of the Mongols. In some ways, the Mongols represent the climax and the epitome of all of the different steppe confederations and empires. In other ways, they are a remarkable exception. Now, this requires us to go back to the Eastern steppes, to move away from the Islamic world, where we've been discussing the interaction between Turkish speakers and Islamic civilization, and return to the Eastern steppes and also to China. And perhaps it's best to start with something of an update of what has been going on in China from the 10th through the 11th centuries, which is simultaneous with events that had been going on in the Islamic world, where we discussed the impact of the Turks on the wider Islamic world, their conquest in Anatolia and India, and the great extension of Islamic civilization, complements of the Turks. Well, let's think back again to the year 907. In that year, the Tang Empire essentially collapsed. A general deposed the last Tang emperor, declared himself a emperor, Taizu, taking a throne name, which is that of an early Tang emperor, and attempted to rule from the Yellow Valley as the new Tang emperor. But actually, the empire had fragmented into a number of rival kingdoms. Later Confucian scholars referred to this period from 907 to 960 as the five dynasties and the ten kingdoms. And this, again, is the conceit that China should always be unified, that there was never really an outside influence, that disunity was an aberration, and a single dynasty with the mandate of heaven was the norm. But in many ways, the Tang Empire had really ceased to be an effective state ever since the An Lushan Rebellion back in the mid-8th century. And furthermore, the breakup of the Tang Empire in the early 10th century resembled in some ways the breakup of the Han Empire after 220. And that meant that the fortifications along the northern frontiers, the Great Wall, and again, I stress, don't think of the current Great Wall, that great Ming structure, the masonry architecture that is a 14th and 15th century construction. The Great Wall was much simpler. It was made of rammed earth and wooden palisades. It was not a continuous fortification. Nonetheless, the wall was seen as a political, moral, and cultural barrier. And that moral barrier collapsed after 907. As a result, new peoples, nomadic peoples, moved into northern China. And in this lecture, we're going to just discuss three of them. The first group are the Khitans. They're not really steppe peoples. They're originally forest people from the Manchurian forests, and they learned nomadic techniques from contact with the ancestors of Mongols and Turks. And it is still a debate as to precisely what language they spoke. Is it Mongolian, a proto-Mongolian? Is it more Turkish, or is it a related language family known as Tangut? Whatever their language was, they came to dominate parts of northern China in the early 10th century and eventually ruled as Chinese-style emperors. In addition, we will talk about two other peoples, Those are going to be the successors to the Khitans. Those are the Jurchens, also coming from Manchuria, and even regarded by the Chinese as wilder, if you can believe that, than the Khitans were initially. And they will take over, especially between 1123 and 1127. They'll essentially overthrow the Khitans and construct a very large North Chinese state. And the final group we'll mention in passing is a group that may have also been Tangut speakers, and those are known in Chinese sources as the Suiya. They will occupy the Ordos Triangle, the Gansu, some of the steppe zones that link the Tarim Basin to Western China. So these are the three players we're going to look at. And of course, we're going to revive the Chinese Empire under the great Sung emperors. So it's a tall order in this lecture. But I think by looking at the interaction of these three new nomadic peoples and the restored Chinese Empire of the Sung in the 10th and 11th century, we will understand why the Mongols emerged and had such a dramatic impact on the 13th century. Well, let's first turn to our Khitans. This state was established in the early 10th century by a fellow by the name of Abalji. He was a leading Khan, if you will, of his tribe, and he carved out a state in northern China. Abalji also took a Chinese throne name, Taizu. That name linked him with the ancient Tang emperors. And initially, he was a lower-level Khan of a lesser tribe. He overthrew his master in 907 and began to rule like a Chinese emperor. The term in Chinese would be Huang Di. And he conquered or initiated the conquests of certain strategic Chinese provinces. This was not completed until his successors, but those provinces were later known as the 16 prefectures. It represented sections of northern China around Beijing today, densely populated, extremely wealthy with agriculture, especially millet, towns. And that small North Chinese possession was actually economically and fiscally the most important part of this emerging Khitan Empire. In addition, Abalji and his successors extended their authority over the other nomadic tribes. And they put together a rather loose confederation because they depended on the military power of the horse archers. And that meant that from the start, the Khitan emperors were sort of ambiguous as exactly how they should style themselves. To their nomadic allies and vassals, they were to be great warriors, in some ways like the Tang warrior emperors, or certainly the early Shuang Nu. Zhanyu, that one extracted silk, silver, other types of goodies from the Chinese distributed among the tribes that sustained both honor and life. On the other hand, they also ruled many Chinese subjects. Estimates run from 10 to 15 million just in the 16 prefectures alone. And that meant they would have to devise an administration by Chinese officials to run this area. So from the start, this empire was a dual empire in that sense. It had a dual administration. Furthermore, Abalji wanted to pass power within his family, father to son, as a Chinese empire would. That is, we might call it a system of primogeniture, would be the English term. And this ran counter with the notions of lateral succession that characterized nomadic peoples. And as I said, the Khitans were originally a forest people, but they had learned nomadic ways, probably by contact with ancestors of the Mongols and the Turks. Therefore, Abalji wanted his older son to succeed, a fellow by the name of Yelu Bei. He was given a fine Chinese education, and he comported himself too much like a Chinese emperor. And when Abalji died, this whole arrangement was set aside, largely by the intrigues of his wife, Xu Luping, a rather remarkable and formidable lady, who comes down through the sources under a number of names, such as the Empress of the Earth. And she was actually to join her husband in death on the which was an old style custom that the consort would be buried with the Khan. She chopped off her right hand and did a token burial and managed to manipulate the succession for, well, like the next three reigns, through various intrigue, and eventually got on the throne a son of hers who represented much more of the old time, nomadic values. And his name was, Yolu, Daguan. And he followed in the tradition of the nomadic warrior, fighting to extend territory in China to exact money out of the Chinese kingdoms. So from the start, the Kittian Empire had this instability within the royal family. What direction do we go? Do we become Chinese emperors, or do we retain that ties with the steppes? And increasingly, over the 10th century and 11th century, more and more emperors opted for the Chinese model. The emperor, Yelu Longzhu is his Kittian name. He ruled under a Chinese name, which is probably better known as Sheng Zong, from 982 to 1031. He really completes the process of turning this empire of the steppes into a Chinese bureaucratic kingdom. They still, the Kittian emperors, who take now the Chinese dynastic name Liao, they still try to project the image of being nomadic conquerors to the tribes, but they have a complicated progress where they go around a number of different cities. There's five major capitals. They spend time cementing ties with the different tribes. This involves, for instance, ties of hospitality, marriages, celebration of events, traditional rites. But on the other hand, they also rule as Chinese emperors, that is, they need Chinese bureaucrats, they set up a court, and they also come into conflict with the Song emperors of southern China, and in 1005, they sign a treaty with the Chinese emperor, Zheng Zhuang, which essentially arranges a partition between the Kittian state and the restored Empire of China to the south. And that treaty in 1005, it's renegotiated on a number of occasions. That specifies the payment of silk, silver in the form of ingots weighed by the tile, which is the Chinese ounce. Also, bronze coins, the so-called cash coins. And there's those treaties reveal that one bolt of silk is equal to 1 ounce of silver, which is equal to 1,000 of the copper cash coins. And the Song have the money to pay this. For the Kittians, this is a major triumph. It establishes the Kittian state as heir to the northern Chinese traditions of the Tang. The Song emperors, however, were furious. The Song court never really accepted it and will do everything in their power to undermine this state. And that's how we'll get eventually to the Jurchens who take over. They're essentially called in by the Song to wipe out the Kittians. This treaty also recognized the independence of that other group I mentioned briefly at the start, the Sui, that is these Tongut speaking people who had embraced Buddhism and who really maintained the Silk Road. That small kingdom, which through the 10th and 11th centuries ruled as essentially an independent Chinese style kingdom, that kingdom really was able to exist because of the conflict between the Kittian emperors, who called themselves the Liao dynasty in Chinese terms, and the Song emperors. And the Sui Suiya proved to be very important in one regard. They had adapted the Chinese characters to write their own version of a script, and they were on good terms with the Uyghurs of the Tarim Basin. And this kingdom, in time, will provide many of the translators and ministers and merchant princes who will advise the Mongol court in the 13th century. Now, to get back to the Song and to our second major nomadic people who have an impact in China at this point, let's return to that treaty in 1005 briefly and look at it from the Chinese viewpoint. The Song emperors, and we'll be talking about the Song a bit more in detail to explain their policy concerns, the Song emperors always postured that they were the heirs to the Han dynasty. And to them, the Great Wall was a moral political boundary. And any part of China, even just the 16 prefectures in the hands of barbarians was unacceptable. The ideology is very clear through the Sung text that they are the Han emperors, they have the mandate of heaven, that the emperor, the Huangdi, represented the true way, the Dao, as it would be called in Taoist texts, and therefore driving the Khitans out was their policy. Except the Sung army just wasn't up to it, as we shall see. And so the way to destroy a barbarian was to summon in another barbarian. And they had someone on hand. His name was Wanyan Aguda. He was the Khan of a people to the north, dwelling on the northern reaches of the Amur River, largely a forest people who engaged in hunting and fishing, but also had learned the techniques of cavalry and were vassals of the Liao dynasty, that is the Khitan emperors. And Wanyan Aguda had a personal quarrel with the Khitan emperor, and he was more than willing. Actually, the quarrel had something to do with the fact that he had to perform some sort of ignominious dance when the Khitan emperor was visiting his territory as part of the imperial progress. But in any event, Wanyan Aguda was more than happy to accept subsidies, technical advisors, especially Chinese military advisors, to wage war against the Khitans. And this alliance, sometimes colorfully called the Alliance on the Sea, because the only way to exchange envoys was essentially to go by water to get around the territories controlled by the Khitan emperors, this alliance ended up in a joint effort to overthrow the Khitan dynasty. And that meant the Jurchen warlords rallied around the Aguda, who launched a major campaign into the Khitan territories and drove the Khitan emperor farther south, right into the hands of the Sung armies, who were making their efforts to make a comeback and retake the 16 prefectures. And the result was the Khitan state found itself between these two opposing forces. Now, Wanyan Aguda conquered much of the Khitan kingdom. The Sung, however, didn't do such a good job, and they were far less effective in reclaiming their territories from the Khitans. And the new ruler of the Jurchens, the brother of Aguda, took the throne. He assumed, his name is Wanyan Sheng, and he took, again, a very high-sounding Tang throne name, Taizong, the great Tang emperor who won great victories over the nomads. And this new Taizong, or Wanyan Sheng, decided that, well, it was nice to take the Khitans. We have the nomadic power. We've got the tribes on our side. And he continued to press south. And the result was that the Sung court finds itself in the embarrassing situation that this new ally turned rival overruns northern China, the North Chinese plain, the Yellow River, captures the northern Sung capital city of Kaifeng in 1127. They also capture the court, including the emperor, Hui Zong, who is at this point in retirement, and the whole court, and the emperor and his court are taken off and die in captivity. The result is the Sung dynasty relocates south. A younger son by the name of Gaozong takes power. He establishes a capital at the modern city of Hangzhou today, then called Lin'an, and he consolidates the Sung empire on the Yangtze or Yangtze. And eventually, the Sung emperors have to come into accommodation with these new invaders. New treaties are concluded. New subsidies are paid. A very, very high cost in terms of silver and silk. The best analysis by scholars is that overall, the